Folks, so I thought it was time to do another deep dive, and I wanted to have a look at the somewhat prophetic H.G. Wells book called The New World Order, which, if you didn't know, he literally wrote a book called The New World Order. And I mean H.G. Wells, who did The Time Machine, War of the Worlds. He was a futurist and he was also a Fabian. And the Fabian Society, he left them because he didn't think they were... He didn't really think they had the imagination that he did. So what I want to take a look at here is the last chapter of the book where he ties up all of the loose ends, because I cannot cover a whole book. This is going to be quite a long video, I think. And have a look at what he's saying and kind of take ownership back away from... Because if you look at H.G. Wells and the New World Order, you do see some quite hysterical things. Another thing that I want to say right at the start here is that I'm not saying that this is a blueprint for what's going on in the world right now. I just want to have a look at what's in this text, because there's a lot of meat in here. Like, it's really quite astounding, to be honest. I'd also like to thank all of the people who donate to me every month, because there's no way that I'd be able to do this kind of video very often at all if it wasn't for their help. So I think we're going to jump in. Now, Wells front loads the book. He prefaces with whether it is attainable, how it can be attained, and what sort of world, a world at peace, will have to be. So it's important to keep in mind that he was writing this in 1939 and into 1940. So it's on the cusp of World War II. That's going on in the background. And basically what Wells is doing here is saying the world can't go on like this. And what he wants is literally a world government and world socialism. And he wants it to be a technocratic world order, without nations any longer. And it's quite surprising how far his thinking took him on this. And in chapter 12 here, which I'm just about to begin, he's actually telling us how it should be done and what's going to be standing in the way. So the chapter is called World Order in Being, and he begins, "There will be no day of days then when a new world order comes into being. Step by step, and here and there, it will arrive. And even as it comes into being, it will develop fresh perspectives, discover unsuspected problems, and go on to new adventures. No man, no group of men, will ever be singled out as its father or founder. For its maker will be not this man or that man, or any man, but man, in capitals. That being who is in some measure in every one of us. World order will be, like science, like most inventions, a social product. An innumerable number of personalities will have lived fine lives, pouring their best into the collective achievement." And this is a running theme in Wells's thought, is collectivism and is socialism, which is where I think he digresses somewhat from what we have today. But we'll come on all of that later. Wells then moves on into a lengthy allegory on flying to make a point of, like, many hands being busy towards the same end. And he says, "We can find a small-scale parallel to the probable development of a new world order in the history of flying. Less than a third of a century ago, 99 people out of 100 would have told you that flying was impossible. Kites and balloons, and possibly even navigable balloon, they could imagine. They had known of such things for 100 years, but a heavier-than-air machine, flying in defiance of wind and gravity, that they knew was nonsense. The would-be aviator was the typical comic inventor. Any fool could laugh at him. Now consider how completely the air is conquered. And who did it? Nobody and everybody. 20,000 brains or so, each contributing a notion, a device, an amplification. They stimulated one another, they took off from one another. They were like excited ganglia in a larger brain, sending their impulses to and fro. They were people of the most diverse race and colour." That's an early mention of the word diverse. you can write down perhaps 100 people or so who have figured conspicuously in the air, and when you examine the role they have played, you will find for the most part that they are mere notorieties, like Lindbergh type, who have put themselves modestly but firmly in the limelight and can lay no valid claim to any effective contribution whatsoever. You will find many disputes about records and priority in making this or that particular step, but the lines of suggestion, the growth and the elaboration of the idea have been an altogether untraceable process. It has been going on for not more than a third of a century under our very eyes, and no one can say precisely how it came about. One man said, "Why not this?" and tried it, and another said, "Why not that?" A vast miscellany of people had one idea in common, an idea as old as Daedalus, the idea that man can fly. Suddenly, swiftly, it got about. That is the only phrase you can use, that flying was attainable, and man as a social being, turned his mind to seriously and flew. So what he's saying is that, well, he's going to go on and say it right now, so it will certainly be with the New World Order, if ever it is attained. A growing miscellany of people are saying it is getting about that world pax is possible. One world. A world pax in which men will be both united and free and creative. It is of no importance at all that nearly every man of 50 and over receives the idea with a pitying smile. Its chief dangers are the dogmatist and the would-be leader, in scare quotes, who will try to suppress every collateral line of work which does not minister to his supremacy. The movement must be and must remain many-headed. So this is not something which is centralised. This is, I mean, you know, I'm thinking back to the Fabian Society, which Wells belonged to, though he did leave it, in fairness. But it is decentralised, and many people in many different places working towards the same end. This movement must be and must remain many-headed. Suppose the world had decided that Santos Dumont or Hiram Maxim was the heaven-sent master of the air, had given him the right to appoint a successor and subjected all experiments to his inspired control. We should have probably have the air master now, with an applauding retinue of yes men, following the hops of some clumsy, useless and extremely dangerous apparatus across country with the utmost dignity and self-satisfaction. So one of the recurring themes in Wells' text, and to be honest, if you watched my video on Spengler and Asimov in Asimov and Foundation, a recurring theme that you'll see through this kind of mindset, which is something that they're terrified of, is the great man of history. This is going to have been especially on Wells's mind right in the 1939-1940, but more generally they are always wary that they've got all of these many hands, you know, in back rooms, these bureaucrats, think tanks here, there and everywhere, pushing towards a certain outcome. And what they always fear is a sort of great man populist type who will just overturn it all and ruin all of the carefully laid plans. And he is talking in terms of laying down plans. Yet that is precisely how we still set about our political and social problems. Bearing this essential fact in mind, that the peace of man can only be attained, if it is attained at all, by an advance upon a long and various front, at varying speed and with diverse equipment, keeping direction only by a common faith in the triple need for collectivism, law and research. We realise the impossibility of drawing any picture of the new order as though it was settled and stable as the old order imagined itself to be. The new order will be incessant. Things will never stop happening, and so it defies any utopian description. But we may nevertheless assemble a number of possibilities that will be increasingly realisable as the tide of disintegration ebbs and the new order is revealed. To begin with, we have to realise certain peculiarities of human behaviour that are all too disregarded in general political speculation. We have considered the very important role that may be played in our contemporary difficulties by a clear statement of the rights of man, and we have sketched such a declaration. Incidentally, after the war, he's right here. Wells actually had a heavy influence with his Rights of Man on the United Nations Charter, which came after World War II. I think it was like 8 years later. There is not an item in that declaration, I believe, which a man will not consider to be a reasonable demand. A universal charter of human rights he's talking about. So far as he himself is concerned, he will subscribe to it in that spirit very readily. But when he is asked not only to concede by the same gesture to everybody else in the world, but as something for which he has to make all the sacrifices necessary for its practical realization, he will discover a reluctance to go as far as that. And he's going to come to what the issue is here, and it's going to be very relatable to a lot of people. He will find a serious resistance. This is the average man he's talking about. He will find a serious resistance welling up from his subconscious and trying to justify itself in his thoughts. The things he will tell you will be very variable, but the word premature will play a large part in it. He will display a tremendous tenderness and consideration with which you have never credited him before, for servants, for workers, for aliens, and particularly, he means foreigners, for aliens of a different colour than himself. So what he's getting at here is that you have this universal rights of man, and this is all well and good in theory, so the average common man will be happy to sign up to that, because, you know, he's going to get his rights protected. But when he becomes aware of the universal nature of it, he's going to resist it, and Wells knows he's going to resist it, and this is what he's addressing here. They will hurt themselves with all this dangerous liberty. So this is what common European men will be thinking of non-Europeans, let's say. Are they fit, he will ask you, for all this freedom? Candidly, are they fit for it? He will be slightly offended if you say, as fit as you are. He will say in a slightly amused tone, but how can you say that? And then go off rather at a tangent, I am afraid you idealise your fellow creatures. So this is back, you know, 1939, 1940. And Wells already knows the kind of arguments and discourse which all of this are going to lead to, and he's preempting it here. This accusation to somebody who on the left, like Wells, that he's idealizing man, that he already knows this is what he's, and they still are accused of that to this day. As you press him, says Wells, you will find this kindliness evaporating from his resistance altogether. He is now concerned about the general beauty and loveliness of the world. He will protest that this new Magna Carta will reduce all the world to a dead level of uniformity. I mean, he could be speaking about me here, because this is exactly what my criticism of the current state of play is, where everything just becomes the same. Back then, Wells knew these arguments would be coming down the pipeline, and he's addressing them right here. You will ask him, why must a world of free men be uniform and at a dead level? You will get no adequate reply. It is an assumption of vital importance to him, and he must cling to it. He has been accustomed to associate free and equal, and has never been bright-minded enough to take these two words apart and have a good look at them separately. He is likely to fall back at this stage, and this bit's brilliant. He is likely to fall back on this stage upon that Bible of the impotent genteel Huxley's Brave New World, and implore you to read it. I mean, wow. So, at this stage, Huxley is, Brave New World is criticizing the one world sort of vision in Brave New World. It's a sort of broadside launched against it, what Wells is proposing here, and Wells knows it, and he doesn't like it. And he says, you brush that disagreeable fantasy aside and continue to press him. So Wells is not very impressed with Huxley's criticism of his ideas at all. I mean, you know, he says that nature has made men unequal, and you reply that it is no reason for exaggerating the fact. The more unequal and various their gifts, the greater is the necessity for a Magna Carta to protect them from one another. Then he will talk of robbing life of the picturesque and the romantic, and you will have some difficulty in getting these words defined. So if you have this idealized romantic view of how your country should be, again, something which I'm accused of all of the time, then what Wells is saying, you have to get him to define what he means by that. Because Wells is very, very much a technocrat and a materialist and empiricist. So if you're more of an idealist, it is very difficult to define exactly what you mean. As it happens, we can do that now to some extent. But yeah, it's just so interesting how he knew what the arguments would be like 80 years later, 50 years later. Just this idea that somebody is going to say, like, robbing the life of the picturesque and the romantic. So this you get these like nostalgic notions of the, say, the Shire in England, and you're going to then say, well, I want it to be like this. And Wells is going to ask, well, can you define that? Define it in, or give me data. Prove it in an empirical terms that this even exists to begin with. You can see, I mean, he isn't going on this full postmodernism thing, but you can see in the thinking the seeds of something here. And then he moves on and he says, sooner or later it will grow clear that he finds the prospect of a world in which Jack's as good as his master unpleasant to the last degree. If you still probe him with questions and leading suggestions, you will begin to realise how large a part the need for glory over his fellows plays in his composition. And incidentally, you will note, please, your own secret satisfaction in carrying the argument against him. It will, I mean, he's really lining up against kind of jumble average Englishman who just likes his place in the world, which is sort of like what I've been arguing for years. So Wells is preempting everything that we could sort of come back with here. And this is like 80 years ago. If you collate the specimen under examination with the behaviour of children, yourself and the people about you, under what urgent necessity they are for the sense of triumph of being better and doing better than their fellows and having it felt and recognised by someone. It is a deeper, steadier impulse than sexual lust. It is a hunger. It is the clue of the unlovingness of so much sexual life to sadistic impulses, to avarice, hoarding, and endless, ungainful cheating and treachery, which gives men the sense of getting the better of someone, even if they do not get the upper hand. So, yeah. In the last resort, this is why we must have and why Magna Carta and all its kindred documents set out to defeat human nature in defense of the general happiness. So this is a good place to start, because what he is acknowledging that if somebody, sort of a nationalist or something, if he's going to invoke natural laws, that he prefers his in-group and that he has the right to a certain patch of land, which he calls his nation, and it's on there that his folk are safe and secure in the world, Wells is agreeing with him. Wells is not saying that this is like some fantasy. He's actually saying, yeah, this is human nature, but it's something to be overcome. And the way he wants to overcome it is what he calls his Magna Carta, which is essentially a universalizing of human rights. So, I mean, the Fabian Society, if I remember rightly, its logo used to be a hammer, like it's hitting the earth. So you see that this is all about acknowledging that, yeah, people tend to be, go along with nature, go along with the in-group. This isn't sort of, he's not denying that's the case. He's saying it has to be socially engineered and crippled through law. So he says law is essentially an adjustment of that craving to glory over other living things, to the needs of social life, and it is more necessary in a collectivist society than in any other. I mean, by collectivist society, he means a socialist society which is a one-world government, not in the sort of in-group preference way which sort of nationalist types talk about. It is a bargain. It is a social contract to do as we would be done by and to repress other extravagant egotisms in return for reciprocal concessions. And in the face of these considerations, we have advanced about the true nature of the beast we have to deal with. It is plain that the politics of the sane man, as we have reasoned them out, must anticipate a strenuous opposition to this primary vital element for bringing about the new world order. So he knows, Wells is saying, he understands the opposition which is going to come along, and it has to be tackled. Well, here he mentions law, but in a bit he's also going to talk about propaganda as well. Okay, so Wells goes on. I have suggested that the current discussion of war aims may very effectively be transformed into the propaganda of this new Declaration of the Rights of Man. The war aims he's talking about is World War II. The opposition to it and the attempts that will be made to postpone, mitigate, stifle and evade it need to be watched, denounced and combated persistently throughout the world. I do not know how far this declaration I have sketched can be accepted by good Catholics, but the totalitarian pseudo-philosophy insists upon inequality of treatment for non-Aryans as a glorious duty. So it's pretty obvious he's talking about the Germans and the Italians at that time, the Axis forces of World War II. It's also interesting to note that Catholics are really suspicious as well. Like, the Catholics tend to get lumped in, and it's all this sort of bag of like reactionary deplorables. Like, you can see he doesn't draw that much of a line between sort of fascists and Catholics. They're all reactionaries to people like H.G. Wells, who in many ways is like the polar opposite of Oswald Spengler. How communists would respond to its clauses would, I suppose, depend on their orders from Moscow, but what are called the democracies are supposed to be different, and it would be possible now to make the declaration a searching test of the honesty and spirit of the leaders and rulers in whom they trust. These rulers can be brought to the point by it with a precision unattainable in any other fashion. But the types and characters and authorities and officials and arrogant and aggressive individuals who will boggle at this declaration and dispute it and defy it do not exhaust the resistances of our unregenerate natures to this implement for the establishment and eliminatory justice in the world. For a far larger proportion of people in among the democracies, he's got in scare quotes, will be found who will pay it lip service and then set about discovering how, in their innate craving for that sense of superiority and advantage which lies so near the core of our individual wills, they may unobtrusively sabotage it and cheat it. He's talking about the doctrines of the universal rights of man here. Even if they only cheat it just a little, I am inclined to think this disingenuousness is a universal weakness. I have a real passion for serving the world, but I have a pretty keen disposition to get more pay for my service, more recognition, and so on than I deserve. I do not trust myself. I want to be under just laws. We want law because we are all potential law breakers. So he's pitching the idea here that I would keep excessive behaviour in check, and at the same time recognising that the worst culprits, in his view, it would be some petty populist who threw all of his ideas into the trash. That's kind of what he's kind of worried about there. This is a considerable digression into psychology, he says, and I will do no more than glance at how large a part this craving for superiority and mastery has played in the sexual practices of mankind. There we have the ready means for a considerable relief of this egotistical tension in mutual boasting and reassurance. But the motive for his digression here is to emphasise the fact that the generalisations of our war aims into a declaration of rights, though it will enormously simplify the issue of the war, will eliminate neither open and heartfelt opposition nor endless possibilities of betrayal and sabotage. Nor does it alter the fact that even when the struggle seems to be drifting definitely towards a world social democracy, there may still be very great delays and disappointments before it becomes an efficient and beneficent world system. So what he wants to do here is frame it so that the Western nations are fighting in the name of universal human rights, which, I mean, to them, they weren't. But this is something which has been imposed on it after the fact, and Wells was saying this is how we have to reframe this later on. Countless people, from Maharajas to millionaires, and from Pukka Sahibs to pretty ladies, will hate the New World Order, be rendered unhappy by frustration of their passions and ambitions through its advent, and will die protesting against it. Wow. When we attempt to estimate its promise, we have to bear in mind the distress of a generation or so of malcontents, many of them quite gallant and graceful-looking people. So there's going to be a lot of good people, he's saying, who are going to oppose his New World Order tooth and nail, and not just in the West, but all over the world. There are going to be rich people, there's going to be poor people, there's going to be prominent people in places like India, and they're all going to protest against it. Some of them will be nice, well-to-do, friendly ladies. A lot of them are going to hate it, and many are going to die fighting against it. But Wells says this is a price worth paying. A generation or so of malcontents, many of them gallant and graceful-looking people. And he moves on and he says, it will be no light matter to minimise the loss of efficiency in the process of changing the spirit and pride of administration work from that of an investing high-salaried man with a handsome display of expenditure and a socially ambitious wife into a relatively less high-salaried man with a higher standard of self-criticism. Aware self-criticism is an interesting slip there. Aware that he will be esteemed rather by what he puts into his work than what he gets out of it. There will be a lot of social spill, tragicomedy, loss of efficiency during the period, the changeover, and it is better to be prepared for that. So the problem is there's a lot of people who have got a lot to lose because of what he's saying here, because of his plan. And they're going to resist it. They're going to find it difficult to downsize, if you like, a high-salaried man and so on. And then he moves on, and he's saying they have to be prepared for that. Yet after making allowances for these transitional stresses, we may still look forward with some confidence to certain phases in the onset of world order. War or war fear will have led everywhere to the concentration of vast numbers of workers upon munition work and the construction of offensive and defensive structures of all sorts, upon shipping, internal communications, replacement structures, fortification. This is relating to the upheaval of the war. There will be both a great accumulation and control of material and constructive machinery, and also of hands already growing accustomed to handling it. As the possibility of conclusive victory fades and this war muddle passes out of its distinctively military phase towards revolution and as some sort of peace congress assembles, it will be not only desirable but necessary for governments to turn over these resources and activities to social reconstruction. So he's kind of taking the long way around of looking towards the post-war order, and of course the United Nations, which again drew on this very doctrine to a large degree, was important in that. So the question then becomes, like, did they stop? Because the United Nations didn't go nearly as far as what Wells would have liked. So then the question is, did the plan just keep on rolling forward? They must surely have learnt now what unemployment means in terms of social disorganisation. Governments will have to lay out the world plan and build for peace whether they like it or not. But, it will be asked, where will you find the credit to do that? And to answer this question, we must reiterate that fact that money is an expedient and not an end. So this is a running theme. So obviously he's a socialist. He goes on a bit of a long digression here about economics, which is my least favourite subject. But what he's saying is that the economics, as a tool to implement the New World Order, we shouldn't get too hung up on a rigid economic system. Let's say, like the Soviet Union did. What he's getting at is that the economic systems can come and go. What matters is that the plan comes in, and in a certain way, that the economic system should just, first and foremost, justify the creation of a new world order. So it isn't that the new world order is going to come in to make everybody rich as its end point. He says they are all about you now crying out to be used. It is, or at any rate it has been, the function of the contemporary money credit system to bring worker and material together and stimulate their union. That system has always justified its activities on that ground, that is its claim to exist. And if it does not exist for that purpose, then for what purpose does it exist, and what further need is there for it? If now the financial mechanism will not work, if it confronts us with a non-possumus, then clearly it resigns its function. So if an economic system is not useful and toward the goal of a new world order, then that economic system has to go. It's as simple as that. The economics will be subservient to this grand design. Then it has to get out of the way, he says. It will declare the world has stopped when the truth will be that the city has stopped. It is the counting house that has gone bankrupt. For a long time now, an increasing number of people have been asking questions about the world counting house, getting down at last to such fundamental questions as what is money and why are banks? It is disconcerting but stimulating to find that no lucid answer is forthcoming. One might have imagined that long before this, one of the many great bankers and financial experts in our world would have come forward with a clear and simple justification for the monetary practices of today. He would have shown how completely reasonable and trustworthy this money credit system was. I will say this is Wells is such a socialist that this isn't actually... He kind of had a point, because in the post-war period, what we really got in the end was neoliberalism. So when Wells is talking about socialism, then he's saying that men should get... It's not so much about making everybody rich. It's about being in a joint effort and getting value from the work itself, rather than like the hoarding of material goods. Now, as it happens, like what happened in the actual, so from definitely from the 70s onwards, places like Germany, it was from the 50s, it wasn't this really at all. What we have today is almost like the polar opposite of that, where everybody's atomized, nobody really gives a damn about everybody else, and everybody's just trying to make as much as they can and not caring about wider community. So, but then, you know, you look at what's coming down the pipeline with UBI and things like that, and you think, well, is he going to have the last laugh? But in the, it seems to me that this didn't happen. This is his kind of socialism, just didn't really come in the decades after the war. For years, there has been a great and growing literature about money, he says. It is very various, but it has one general characteristic. First, there is a swift exposure of the existing system as wrong. Then there is a glib demonstration of a new system, which is right. Let this be done or that be done. Let the nation own its own money, says one radio prophet earnestly, repeatedly, simply, and all will be well. These various systems of doctrine run periodicals, organize movements with colour shirt complete, meet, demonstrate. They disregard each other flatly, and without exception, all these monetary reformers betray signs of extreme mental strain. The secret trouble in their minds is gnawing doubt that their own proper plan, the panacea, is in some subtle and treacherous way likely to fail them if it is put to the test. The internal fight against this intolerable shadow betrays itself in their outer behaviour. Their letters or pamphlets, with scarcely any exception, have this much in common with the letters one gets from lunatics, that there is a continual resort to capital letters and abusive terms. They shout out at the slightest provocation anon. They are not so much shouting at the exasperated reader who remains so obstinate when they have been so clear as to add the sceptical whisper within. because there is no perfect money system by itself, and there never can be. It is a dream, like the elixir or perpetual motion. It is in the same order of thought. Attention has already been drawn in our examination of Mr. Streit's proposals for Union Now to the fact that money varies in its nature and operations with the theory of property and distribution on which society is based, that in a complete collectivism, for example, it becomes little more than the cheque handed to the worker to enable him to purchase whatever he likes from the resources in the community. Every detachment or production or enterprise from collective control, national or cosmopolitan, increases the possible functions of money and so makes a different thing of it. Thus, there can be endless species of money, as many types of money as there are types and variations of social order. Money in Soviet Russia is a different organ from money, French or American money. The difference can be as wide as that between lungs and swimming bladders and gills. It is not simply a quantitative difference, but as so many people seem to imagine, which can be adjusted by varying the rate of exchange or any such contrivance. It goes deeper. It is a difference in quality and kind. All right, so he goes really quite in depth about the money situation. Clever people reaped a certain advantage from a more or less definite apprehension of the variable nature of money, but since one could not be a financier or business director without an underlying faith in one's right to profit by one's superior cleverness, there did not seem to be any reason for them to make a public fuss about it. They got their profits and the flats got left. Directly we grasp this is not very obscure, the truth of the camera. So Wells goes on to say the stock exchange and bank credit and all arts of loaning and usury are going to be done away with in the world order. This absolutely has not happened in any way, shape or form. Usury is a term he uses quite a bit, and that's still very much with us. They will be superseded like eggshells and fetal membranes, he says. Our attempt to forecast the coming world order is framed then in an immense and increasing spectacle of constructive activity. We can anticipate a rapid transfiguration of the face of the earth as its population is distributed and redistributed in accordance with the shifting requirements of economic production. Yeah, I mean, that's basically open borders where the population of the world will just be moved to where economic production requires them. So it is not only that there is what is called a housing shortage, and by the way, like that can happen because they've already used the laws, the human rights laws, universal rights, and sort of crippled the people who would not want that to happen, which is what he addressed earlier on. It is not only that there is what is called a housing shortage in nearly every region of the earth, but that most of the existing accommodation by modern standards is unfit for human occupation. There is scarcely a city in the world, the new world as well as the old, which does not need to have half its dwelling places destroyed. This is standard, like socialist stuff, just making, building, improving on things, using the state. He gets into something interesting here. You can hardly say people are born in such surroundings, they are only half born. And then he moves on and he says, with the cooperation of the press and the cinema, it would be easy to engender a worldwide public interest and enthusiasm for the new types of home and fitment that are now attainable for everybody. Here would be an outlet for urban and regional patriotism, for local shame and pride and effort. So what he's talking about here is using the press and the cinema, propaganda, basically. He's on about using propaganda to engineer a sort of local, sort of civic patriotism in people, rather than a national one or an ethnic one or anything like that. He's looking at the way which propaganda can be used to mould people to where they are, which are not going to be, they'll have an outlet for patriotism and pride and things like that, but it's not going to be one which threatens the system. In fact, it's going to facilitate it. So this big kind of astroturfed patriotism, which will be facilitated. But again and again, we see this is all social engineering. The way these people think, and this is like a technocrat. He is the arch technocrat. It's the complete opposite of the thinkers which I would usually speak about, you know, you'd hear about on right-wing YouTube. He says, here would be stuff to argue about. Wherever men and women have been rich enough, powerful enough and free enough, their thoughts have turned to architecture and gardening. Here would be a new incentive to travel to see what other towns and countrysides were doing. The common man on his holidays would do what the English milord of the 17th century did. He would make his grand tour and come back from his journeys with architectural drawings and notions of home application, open borders. You know, this is the sort of the upside of it. You get to easily go wherever you want, and the socialist New World Order, Wells's view, is going to facilitate. And this building and rebuilding will be a continuing process, a sustained employment going on from good to better as the economic forces shifted and changed with new discoveries and men's ideas expanded. It is doubtful in a world of rising needs and standards if many people would want to live in manifestly old houses. So it's more of the improving the lot of the masses, which is a standard left-wing thing. And you know, it's fair enough. I don't mind that so much. In large open countries as the United States, there has been a considerable development of the mobile home in recent years. People haul a trailer home behind their cars and become seasonal nomads, but there is no need to expatiate further on a limitless wealth of possibilities. So this is, he's really trying to give it a positive pitch here, this great future. But it is interesting because what he's talking about are like creations of the capitalism. It's, you know, you think of the American with the trailer behind, like that's all capitalism. But he's like, we can do it better. There must be a multitude of young and youngish people quite ripe for infection by this idea of cleaning up and resettling the world. So let's get to the youth. Let's get these ideas and the youth, which they would do in the 60s. Young men who are now poring over war maps and planning annexations and strategic boundaries, fresh Maginot lines, new Gibraltars and Dardanelles, may presently be scheming the happy and healthy distribution of routes and residential districts in relation to this or that important region of world supply for oil or wheat or water power. It is essentially the same type of celebration, better employed. So Wells goes on for quite a long time, and his basic point is that the youth of the world at that point, they were just wasting all of their talents. They were doing things that didn't really amount to very much, or that they were going in the wrong direction. But he's mainly referring to the war effort, as he mentioned about, you've got all these young men and they're sort of strategizing and planning further ways to annex resources and build fortifications and this kind of thing. So Wells says this is all just a complete waste of time and talent and youth. But then he also says that like a sort of criticism that people levy at socialism is that it doesn't have any incentive structure. And really what Wells' point here, his retort to that, is that you can see that the people who are engaged in this huge effort on all sides and in all countries, on the lead up to World War II and then during World War II itself, the same thing applies, is that they're not doing it for money and they're not doing it for personal gain. They're doing it for the greater good of whatever country they happen to be in. So Wells is saying, well, we can just go one step further and make them do that, but for the whole world. Which is, it's, you know, he's a formidable thinker, I will say that. One of the leading probability of a collectivist world order has to be noted here, and that is an enormous increase in the pace and the amount of research and discovery. I write research, but by that I mean the double-barreled attack upon ignorance, the biological attack and the physical attack that is generally known as science, in scare quotes. Science comes to us from the academic dark ages when men had to console themselves for their ignorance by pretending that it was a limited amount of knowledge in the world. and little chaps in caps and gowns strutted about, bachelors who knew all there was to be known, now it is manifest that none of us know very much. And the more we look into what we think we know, the more hitherto undetected things we shall find lurking in our assumptions. The business of research, which we call the scientific world, has been in the hands of very few workers indeed. I threw out the suggestion that in our present day world, all of the brains capable of great and masterful contributions to scientific thought and achievements, brains of the quality of Lord Rutherford's, Darwin's, Mendel's, Freud's, Leonardo's or Galileo's, not one in a thousand, not one in a score of thousands, ever gets born into such conditions as to realise its opportunities. So the great mass of geniuses have just gone undetected in the world, he's saying. The rest never learn a civilised language, never get near a library, never had the faintest chance of self-realisation, never hear the call. They are undernourished, they die young, they are misused. Again, he's got a point, to be honest. And of the millions who would make good, useful, eager, secondary research workers and explorers, not one in a million is utilised. But now consider how things will be if we had a stirring education ventilating the whole world, and if we had a systemic and continually more competent search for exceptional mental quality and a continually more extensive net of opportunity for it. Suppose a quickening public mind implies an atmosphere of increasing respect for intellectual achievement and livelier criticism of imposture. What we will call scientific progress today would seem a poor, hesitating, uncertain advance in comparison with what would be happening under these happier conditions. The progress of research and discovery has produced such brilliant and startling results in the past century and a half that few of us are aware of the small number of outstanding men who have been concerned in it, and how the minor figures behind these leaders trail off into a following of timid and ill-provided specialists who dare scarcely stand up to a public official on their own ground. This little army, this scientific world of today, numbering, I suppose, from head to tail down to the last water washer, not a couple of 100,000 men, will certainly be represented in the New World Order by a force of millions. Better equipped, amply coordinated, free to question, able to demand opportunity. So Wells is going to wrap things up here with his final couple of paragraphs, his final flourish. And he says, one can doubt that the scientific world, I mean, this idea of a scientific world, and you look at the world today, you know, this is kind of on point. But, and you can see, so the reason why I find this interesting is because you try and figure out what's going through the heads of the world elite today. So he says this will break out in this way when the revolution is achieved. The revolution isn't like an sort of overturning, violent bloodbath, Russian Revolution type thing. As he's outlined again and again in this, it is an incremental, many hands at work across many institutions to bring this about. And that the development of man's power over nature and over his own nature and over this still unexplored planet, which it was, I suppose, just back then in 1939, 1940, will undergo a continual acceleration as the years pass. No man can guess beforehand what doors will open then, nor upon what wonderlands. These are some fragmentary imitations of the quality of that wider life a new world order can open to mankind. I will not speculate further upon them because I would not have it said that this book is utopian or imaginative or anything of that sort. I have set down nothing that is not strictly reasonable, that's debatable, and practicable. It is the soberest of books and the least original of books. I think I have written enough to show that it is impossible for world affairs to remain at their present level. Either mankind collapses or our species struggles up by the hard yet fairly obvious routes I have collated in this book to reach a new level of social organisation. there can be little question of the abundance, excitement and vigour of living that awaits our children upon that upland, if it is attained. There is no doubting their degradation and misery, if it is not. Again, debatable. There is nothing really novel about this book, but there has been a certain temerity in bringing together facts that mean people have avoided bringing together for fear that might form an explosive mixture. Maybe they will. They may blast through some obstinate mental barriers. Again, the mental barriers, which is just how we like to live our lives. In spite of that explosive possibility, that explosive necessity, it may be this remains essentially an assemblage, digest and encouragement of how not prevalent but still hesitating ideas. It is a plain statement of the revolution to which reason points an increasing number of minds, but which will still lack resolution to undertake. In the fate of Homo sapiens, I have stressed the urgency of the case. Here I have assembled the things that can and need to do. They had better summon up their resolution. So he's calling on people to get to work. And by the time the United Nations came in, that was the first that they documented that it was based largely on this. So the question then becomes, to what degree is the world that we live in today influenced by this text? There's an interesting question pops up around, say, capitalism and money, because is it the case that because obviously in the West, the socialism, and as he imagined it, just didn't happen. The money lending and capitalism has run absolutely rampant. But then he also says these things can be just used as tools to bring about the end goal. So is it that something like neoliberalism is just a tool being used to hammer the world in a certain shape before the final act appears? Which, you know, could be what's going on now. But I'm going to leave that for the viewers to decide for themselves. And moreover, this video is long enough. So thanks for listening, folks, and I'll catch you later.